For this week's podcast, we focus on something we see in our clinical practice quite frequently. It greatly affects a good deal of our patients, and that is canker sores, also known in our vernacular as aphis ulcers. We're going to go over what exactly is a canker sore, what the onset is, what causes them, how to prevent them, what some complications they happen to have around them, and also how to treat them. So I'll sit down with part of our research team, Huma Karim, and hopefully in this talk that will give you some understanding of what's happening if you are an individual who suffers from them, and also some ways and strategies to treat them and also how to prevent them. So thank you for sitting down with us. Let us know any questions you have. There'll be some show notes on our website, and I wish you well. Hello, Huma.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good. Good. We're having a good day so far, right?
I think we are, except the cold. The cold is what's throwing us off.
We sit down here in New York. We film this in right on a space adjacent to our clinical practice, the Upper East Side of New York City. So at the time of recording, it was 14 degrees this morning. So we hope that you're listening to this somewhere and some time where it's warmer and sunny out wherever you may be and that you're having a good day. We're sitting here to tackle a topic that some of our patients suffer from and we see in our clinical practice. And we'd like to give you some strategies to deal with them if you're one that suffers from canker sores. We call them aphis ulcers in our clinical chart when we're writing it, and we see you in our textbooks. So we're going to sit down here and give you an easy digestible strategies and format to go through what they are, how to treat them, how to prevent them.
So before we jump into it, I actually have a question to ask you. Generally speaking, I feel like in today's modern dentistry and speech, I feel like there's a lot more focus on urgent and chronic conditions. So topics like canker sores might get a little less attention in the broader field of healthcare. So why do you think that is? I think that's a great place to start.
I think that a lot of the things that are being tackled, whether it's in the New York Times or on social media, are things that are going to get clicks, clicks, click, clicks, right? Luckily, the game that we're playing here is to connect with people who are having an issue. They can find this somewhere on the internet or on our website and solve a solution. But unfortunately, it's not exactly a sexy topic talking about canker sores, right? People who suffer from it in our clinical practice, it's quite debilitating at the time of experiencing it. We'll have people who are getting married in a week or so or having a big presentation. They're going for a job interview and they're having a hard time speaking and they're in agony because of the situation, especially the individuals who suffer from having not a mild case. The ones that suffer from the moderate to severe cases, people whose tongue gets populated with the ulcers and their mouth, and they're having a hard time speaking, eating, and just actually existing with their basic homeostasis. They're quite painful and disruptive. So we felt that it was a really good topic to jump into and break down for people to give them some actionable information, simple strategies to deal with these. And well, I don't know why people aren't talking about things like that, but that's where they can figure that out. But I just think it's not exactly the most mainstream enough in our clinical practice that it affects people pretty severely. So we'll jump into it and go from there. So I guess the question is, what is a canker sore compared to other lesions in your mouth, correct?
Yes.
To basically say it is, we actually do not know what causes a canker sore in our profession. We call them, again, what an aphis ulcer. Know that these are non-contagious mouth sores, right? They can also be called recurrent aphis stomatitis. And the reason that that's calling that is because it actually refers to an inflammatory process in your mouth. Some people can get one or two canker sores where others can have continuous outbreaks through their entire mouth. And the frequency alters depending on the time of year, stress in your life, hormone cycle, and also your own systemic situation. And these typical are lesions that are these roundish lesions, typically followed by a red outline. And again, they're always coupled with pain. I suffer from them a couple times a year, so I can relate, but luckily I cannot relate to people who get them frequently. But you can tell we have patients in our practice that have to have real strategies for dealing with this. They're typically formed on the non-keratinized tissues in your mouth. That means the protein less rich, the movable tissues, right? So your cheeks, the floor of your mouth, the sides of your tongue, in a sense, in the posterior region. They also are people, and we have plenty of people in our practice that suffer from them, on the keratinized protein-rich tissues. So actually on the tongue, on different areas. And these are all internal to the mouth, right? They are non-contagious. There is no viral sense of it. And we'll go through the process a little bit moving forward. 46 of patients report to having this lesion. So it's almost half of the population suffers from some level of having aphthous ulcers or canker sores?
I think the common misconception is that a lot of people don't know the difference between a canker sore and a cold sore. So I think it would be worth to kind of double click on that and explain the key differences.
A cold sore is something that is outside of your mouth and viral, right? Herpetic lesion, recurrent, and we'll sit down and go through a whole talk on that in the future. You know, it's on the list of things to do. So these are internal in your mouth, and these are, as we'll get into, an inflammatory immune response. So it has no viral component. They're not contagious versus things that happen along your lip that are known as cold sores. And those are herpetic lesions that are dealt with systemic medications, most frequently are ointments that you put on the lesion itself.
What is exactly happening here that you think patients should understand more?
So you're getting an actual immune response here. You're getting lymphocytes that infiltrate the epithelium of the area. You get edema, which is swelling. Epithelial cells go through this vascularization and change, and then it sloughs, right? So you're getting an immune response, neutrophils, lymphocytes, and they start this then inflammatory response after the immune response that happens, a T-cell mediated immune response that then reacts with inflammatory cells. Then you get the ulceration. So the progression is this coupled response, right? It's not an autoimmune response. It's actually an immune response that's then followed by an inflammatory response that causes disruption and pain on people. We typically classify it cellularly as a T-celled immune response to T-cell mediated immune response. And so that's really thinking about it being your immune system taking action against something. If you were to do the histology on an early lesion, you're getting about 80% of the area is made up of T-cells. So you're getting this intense, like I said, immune response that then inflammation occurs. So from my understanding and appreciation of your mouth and your oral environment, has to be some type of traumatic lesion that either allows some type of bacteria to infiltrate or a disruption of your own bacteria that causes an irritation that your body kind of triggers this response in a protective manner to the area. And so what I would like people to realize is it's a part of the physiological process of your mouth and your body that happens everywhere of this protective mechanism. So the way I look at it, and I think if you suffer from it, you can think about is it's that your body's protecting itself from something. What exactly? I'm not sure. Maybe a couple of things at a time. We notice people break out with them depending on their own body changing in terms of becoming of a more inflamed state or a more immune compromised state. Their body's reacting and it's coming out in their mouth, whether it's from toothpaste, whether it's from something being hit or trauma or disruption from the local bacteria. So I think that it's being caused from a couple of different things provoking the same response that comes out. And it's happening more on people who are more susceptible to it, or it's happening to you at a moment you are more susceptible to getting it. To just break that down, so not knowing the exact etiology and the cause of what's causing the aphthous ulcer, we could understand what leads the events that occur that lead to it, right? So it could be trauma to your mouth, injury. You could bite your cheek. You could have a dental cleaning and just the action or a dental appointment, the action in your mouth. Stress and anxiety is making you more susceptible to having inflammatory or immune responses or disrupting the microbiome. So I'm not sure the chicken or the egg here, but the environment matters of yourself systemically. With that, hormone changes. We see women that go through their monthly cycles, there might be an uptick at a certain point of the cycle. Women that are pregnant may get a different change also. So we have some patients when they're breastfeeding, it goes away completely until they finish breastfeeding and then it comes back. Quite interesting. Patients who suffer from GI issues such as Crohn's disease, celiacs, ulcerative colitis, we also see a higher prevalence of these aphthous ulcers in your mouth. We find that there's a genetic correlation. So I have a couple of families in our clinical practice and the siblings all suffer from these, right? Quite similarly. It doesn't matter the gender actually, they all get them. It's quite interesting. The other thing that can happen is that we can find a complete correlation with dental products that contain irritants to your mouth, such as whitening toothpaste or sodium lauryl sulfate, SLS, which is a sudsy thing in toothpaste. So if you ever brush with different toothpaste and some are to make you feel fresher or make you feel more clean, this is also irritating the soft tissue in your mouth, sodium lauryl sulfate. So it's something that we almost recommend our patients to just stay away from completely because there's no reason to have a soft tissue irritant in your toothpaste. Nevertheless, if you are part of the 50% that suffer, stay away from it. If you're part of the 50% of our patients that do not suffer from aphthous ulcers, there's still not a great benefit in feeling fresher, right? It's nice to feel fresh, I guess, but you're actually not gaining any more cleansability by feeling fresher. Those are things we come into account, the things we think about that you need to be mindful of. You're a person that suffers from these, you want to avoid them, to kind of think about what are your risk factors and what are the things you could be doing that could lead to these.
You know, Rob, it's really interesting. You mentioned about an immune response. So would you say a weakened immune system is something that can trigger the onset or a cause of a canker sore?
I definitely think that's part of the issue. We find that when people are more stressed, people have anxiety, you're getting more of these. So I think that that's happening right there. So there's either individuals that suffer from having a chronically low immune system, immunocompromised patients are definitely suffering from these more, or situationally through your life, if you're going through a big job change or you're moving, you're stressed, a breakup, a wedding, whatever it may be, you're more likely to get these because your immune system is getting disrupted, right? The other thing that we see is the disruption in your microbiome. There are studies showing when they take the histology of these lesions that there's a complete disruption of the microbiome locally in just the area of the lesion, not in the areas of your mouth where the lesion is not. So who knows, again, how that's happening, either a local problem or a systemic issue or a stress issue that's affecting your overall immune system at that moment. We also see patients who have vitamin deficiencies and iron deficiencies suffer from an increased amount of aphthous ulcers. Iron, folic acid, vitamin B12. Now, we're not sure about people who suffer from these vitamins or have deficiencies in iron. Is it the question of a lower immune system or a hyperinflammatory response, right? We see people who have deficiencies in B12 and folic acid having higher level of homocysteine inflammatory markers. So what is causing it? I'm not sure. But we definitely see in the literature an increased occurrence in these. And again, we see them as in women with hormonal changes, right? So menopause, menstruation, it's showing to have an increased risk of aphthous ulcers during these hormonal changes that women suffer from.
So Rob, what would you say are some preventative measures that one could take to help prevent canker sores?
You want to try to figure out if there's something that's happening in you that leads to them, right? For example, if you're a woman who gets them as your menstrual cycle changes, you can think about hormonal introduction like birth control pills if it's debilitating. You can try to understand, is it SLS toothpaste causing it? So globally, you would try to take care of things that would irritate your mouth and avoid those. Acidic food, spicy foods, irritants, chewing gum, cough drops might have a little sharp edge that might just scratch your gum tissue. The hygiene products that you use and how you use them, flossing, toothpaste, are all important. Unfortunately, because we can't really isolate the etiology of what's causing them directly, talking about how to prevent them is hard because there might be a handful of things that are happening here. I guess the thing that I would do if I was a person who suffered from them regularly is I would introduce a probiotic, right? The one thing we can say for sure is that there's a local disruption around the tissue and the microbiome when this is occurring in the area of the lesion. Well, if that's the case, let's try to make sure that you're using an oral probiotic, right? This is not a pill that you're swallowing for your GI tract, but a lozenge that dissolves in your mouth. We use Burst in our practice. There's no affiliation. In our clinical practice, we have every patient for every time they have a hygiene appointment finish with a probiotic to help repopulate their mouth of healthy bacteria. So that's something that I would do nightly after my oral hygiene regimen to try to prevent them. There's a few types of different aphthous ulcers going from minor, major to herpetic form. And herpetic form does not mean it's a viral influence. It's just a classification style. And most people suffer from minor. Right? 80% of people deal with having a minor form, 1 to 4 month interval, smaller than 5 millimeters. These people typically deal with it themselves. They're self-limiting. They don't need a lot of treatments and you can keep moving and let it go. There are the population, and those are the people we see in our clinical practice that have what is classified as major types or the herpetic ulcerations. Major is about 10 to 15% of individuals who suffer from aphthous ulcers, and these can last even longer than the normal 7 to 10 days. We'll go through the strategies of how to treat them, and I think that's the most important thing that we can kind of jump into next is how do you treat them when they happen? Because I think that's the biggest confusion around these, and that's probably the most important part of the conversation, because if we can't isolate exactly what causes them and we can't prevent stress or immune changes at times or hormonal changes, we can't remove them, let's live in the space of how do we treat them when they occur. This way you're not slowing the healing, but yet dealing with it in the way that suits you best. The way I like to think about treating these ulcerations is there's two types of ways that I think about it. One is, how does a patient treat them on their own with no intervention from a healthcare professional? And then secondly, if it gets to the point where that's not sustaining your existence when you get the lesions, how do you get an actual health professional, a dentist, to intervene and treat them? With that said, the first thing to do is, if you suffer them, is no treatment at all, right? They're self-limiting. Your immune response followed by the inflammatory response will occur, and this will last about 7 to 10 days, and you will go through the healing process and it will heal. The one thing we want to stress to our patients in our clinical practice is to avoid benzocaine, right? Also known as ambisol. This is an ointment that you put on the lesion that causes numbness. So part of the problem with that is it's also an irritant, and this will actually delay healing. I would think that this product should only exist or be used situationally, not as a solution to the lesion. But if you have an ulceration in your mouth and you have something you're doing that would require you to not have pain, a job interview, you're at your wedding and your vows are being exchanged, to be dramatic, but anything that kind of you can't avoid speaking, it wouldn't be something that you could sustain through the entire length of the lesion, or should, because you're going to delay the healing. Again, it's a localized irritant, numbing it, but then irritating it. A better solution could be rinsing with a topical corticosteroid. This is a prescription that you can get. Fluconazine in 0.05% could be something that you can rinse with and use. And that's something that'll help with the whole immune and inflammatory response, right? Some patients can definitely benefit from systemic steroids, right? A metronidazole pack could be very helpful. And the dosage can be as prescribed in the steroid packs, or it can be also tapered down. You can do almost half a response, and that could help also. Something to work with your healthcare professional directly. We do incorporate this with our patients when the lesions are multiple sites, large lesions. We'll have these patients go on these metronidazole packs because you really just need to quiet the whole system, lower the inflammation of the area to help it heal. And it's terribly effective. It's just you have to make a decision to take systemic steroids, which comes along with a different set of side effects. A simple thing that you can do, again, a prescription, is have a chlorhexidine rinse. So this is a prescription strength mouth rinse, antibacterial rinse, and this has been shown to shorten the length of the lesion, to reducing the bacterial load around the lesion and allowing your body to heal it faster. It's a prescription that you would get from your dentist. Simple. You probably call them up if you're suffering from this. It called in for you. You might not even need an appointment. It's not that type of prescription. Just note that a lot of the pharmacies carry an alcohol-containing rinse, which can dehydrate the system. With my patients, what I would prefer them do if they're suffering from an aphthous ulcer and they choose to use a rinse is to take a Q-tip or like a cotton ball, right? And just saturate the lesion slightly a couple times a day. That's probably a better approach than actually rinsing your whole mouth with it if you're having just a couple of lesions. Treat the lesions themselves so you're not killing all the bacteria in your mouth. People have also used things like tetracycline or doxycycline rinses. Again, these are prescription strength antibiotics that you can rinse with, helping to allow the area to heal. One would do is take a doxycycline capsule, empty it out into about 10 milliliters of water, so 100 milligram capsule of doxycycline, empty into 10 mils of water, and then you could rinse with that a couple times a day, typically 3 times a day, or tetracycline. There's a couple different things, and you would work with your healthcare professional themselves to see which one they prefer to use. But you would use that rinse throughout the cycle of the lesion, and it would help it to heal. And then the last thing we'll talk about is an overlapping treatment that you can administer yourself. Typically, a dentist would be the one administering it, and that's dabacterol, right? Dabacterol is a topical treatment. It's a sulfuric acid, ranges from 2 to 3 on the pH scale. And so you would take the solution and apply it directly to the lesion. This is a chemical cauterization, and it would help to actually remove the pain from it by searing, cauterizing the nerve endings there. Interestingly enough, this also helps to increase the rate of healing. It's removing the inflamed tissue and possibly also changing the microbiome of the area, allowing it to heal faster. This typically is something that we administer to patients in our clinical practice. Although I do have plenty of patients who suffer from the ulcerations routinely, who we can order a bottle of it, give it to them, and they can self-administer it carefully, right? You have to be dexterous and see the lesion. You dry the lesion, treat it for a couple seconds, 5 seconds, and then rinse out afterwards. It's a very simple way. When I have a lesion in my mouth that is disruptive, which again is rare for me, luckily, I will treat it with Dabactrol. And that typically is all I need to really just take the edge off and to help it to heal.
Is there any side effects for the use of Dabactrol?
The main side effect is the pain you get immediately from using it, right? It's an intense sting at the moment of using it. You have to get it. So there's a friction point where you have to get it from your dentist and pay for it. So there's a few barriers of entry. It's not as simple to use other things. So we've gone through some interventions a patient can do on their own and kind of what the most common dentist-driven intervention is. And the last thing that people do is laser therapy, low-level laser therapy. And so in dentistry, there's a handful of different types of lasers of different wavelengths available for different treatments. There are hard tissue lasers, soft tissue lasers. You might see throughout advertising, they advertise for procedures that are laser-driven treatments. So there's been some studies to try to look at what type of lasers work best and how they're administered. And it turns out that the best way for a laser treatment to be effective is accompanied with local anesthetic. So part of the problem with a laser is to get to the treatment that you need to cause discomfort removal and also accelerated healing is actually something that typically cannot be done with just topical anesthetic. So there's a barrier there. But for someone who's suffering from a debilitating aphys ulcer, this is a very, very effective treatment. And the good news is that it alternates on the type of laser. There's not one type of laser that works best for this. It's the laser being used on the proper setting. So most lasers that a dentist may have can do this treatment on an aphys ulcer if the settings are done right and the technique is done properly. Again, the only problem with this is accompanied with local anesthetic to get to the level of laser therapy that you need to cause cessation of the pain associated with an aphys ulcer. Interesting and not so interestingly enough, but they found in the studies when accompanying the therapy with omega supplementation and B12 supplementation, they found that, of course, the laser therapy was more effective because two of the things that we do as a supplementation, I do myself daily, I try to do daily, is a methylated B12 and omegas. Right. So if you're doing that, you're helping with lowering the inflammation in your body. And of course, on some level, you'll lower the inflammation around your mouth and accelerate healing. And lastly, we'll include in the show notes, and if you're watching this, we'll pop this up on the screen. But there are some common treatments and different dosages accompanied with those, and then the studies that we have related to the treatments. And so we reviewed previously the things that we recommend, and these are just listed out here if you're suffering from them and you need a resource to try some different approaches. And that's the thing that we'll kind of end on here is to figure out, if you can, on any level, to correlate why or when you're getting them, how you're getting them, and then try a few different treatments, right? You could try the Dabactrol, chlorhexidine. I would try to do those things first. And I guess the last thing I would say, you can also manage the discomfort with these with over-the-counter pain medication. It's a very effective way, whether it's acetaminophen or something like Aleve, ibuprofen, Motrin. You can try to manage the discomfort systemically also if you're having a few tough days and knowing that some of the treat things that you could buy over the counter would intervene with the healing process. Find, as we always say, find what works best for you and try to figure out what your approach is that is most effective. When you need it, rely on your healthcare professionals around you to help you through the process and assist you where you need. And let us know if you have any questions. Please leave a comment. We'll make sure we get back to them. And I really appreciate your time and your attention here. And we wish you well. And if you suffer from these, we hope you get better.
Thank you for joining us this week. I hope you found it helpful and enjoyable. Please head to our website for our show notes and more information around the topics we discussed today. Please check us out on our YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok pages for weekly updates and other interesting topics we discuss more frequently. The information provided in this podcast is for general information and educational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional advice. Accordingly, before taking any actions based on such information, we encourage you to consult with the appropriate professional. We do not provide any medical nor health advice. You should seek the full diagnosis and treatment from your healthcare providers for any issues or conditions you may have. No doctor and patient relationship is formed. The use or reliance of any information used from this podcast is solely at your own risk. This podcast is purely for educational and informative purposes only.